Two songs by Marlene Dietrich. It's 10 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM WUHY in Philadelphia. And with me are film critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, who until a few weeks ago were the hosts of Sneak Previews, a program of clips and reviews of new films. Sneak Previews was the highest-rated half-hour weekly program in the history of public television. They recently left public television to do a show with a nearly identical format called At the Movies, which is commercially syndicated and can be seen in Philadelphia on Channel 48, 7:30, Saturday evenings, repeated Sunday at 7:30. Siskel and Ebert are both based in Chicago, where they're the film critics for two rival papers and two rival TV stations. Ebert is with the Chicago Sun-Times and WMAQ-TV, the Chicago NBC affiliate. And Siskel is with the Chicago Tribune and WBBM-TV, the Chicago CBS affiliate. They both received an Emmy in 1979 for Sneak Previews. And by the way, in 1975, Roger Ebert became the only film critic to ever win a Pulitzer Prize for film criticism. And I should also mention he wrote the screenplay for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which one of our listeners
might be interested in. Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't. I really wish it would come to Philadelphia at a time when I could see it. I've only seen one
Midnight
of the
Russmeyer
films.
Midnight is not convenient for you.
Yeah, that's right. It certainly isn't. Well, welcome, both of you. I've enjoyed both your shows.
Thanks.
And
nice
I'm glad you're able to be here. Why did you switch from public television to commercially syndicated programming?
Well, I suppose I could give a long answer, but I'll give a short one. We didn't really, in my opinion, leave PBS so much as we left the PBS station in Chicago, which offered us a contract that we just simply couldn't sign. And in a nutshell, the contract would have given them the power to take us off of PBS and syndicate us commercially themselves. We didn't want to sign that contract, and eventually, after working without a contract for 8 or 9 months, we left for Tribune Productions, which is syndicating us now.
So you felt you just couldn't sign?
No, they made us an offer we couldn't accept, to use a phrase. And we felt that the game was changing at this station. We obviously had only nice feelings about PBS, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We never met anybody from those organizations. We just worked out of the Chicago station, and it was sold around to other stations like the one here in Philadelphia. And we met some people from the public station in Philadelphia this afternoon, and I really had a couple of messages for them. One, which is, I'm sorry we're not on, because I have high regard for the work that is done at PBS stations, but it's not me that's the reason.
We didn't jump, we were pushed.
Yeah.
We weren't fired, but we were given a contract that we couldn't.
It was very restrictive, and they really wanted to tie up 4 years of our life in terms that we just didn't want to. They really thought we had no alternative, and I know a lot of people are thinking, well, we did it for the money, but I just ask you to think of this little simple proposition. We were the very popular show. The simplest thing to do would be stay on and run for a long time, like Book Beat was a show that ran for a long, long time. And you may think we did it for the money, but the obvious answer is that we had a lot of money in the bank, so to speak, with staying on for a long time. We took a risk on principle because we didn't want to sign what they wanted us to sign. And we could fall flat. What's nice, of course, is that the early ratings here in Philadelphia on Channel 48 and
Elsewhere
across the country are very strong, which is unusual for a show just getting started.
We came
in
out of the box
stations.
Doing much stronger ratings than Sneak Previews ever did.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to make sure in whatever contract you signed with the commercial syndication that you'd be able to do the show you wanted to? Because sometimes I think that when a commercial station woos someone away from a public station, that no matter what they say, they'll change or try to change what it is that you've done.
Well, now
you've
seen the new show At the Movies.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more or less?
No, I think there's just a little bit less of it to make room for the commercials. Otherwise, it seems to be pretty identical, with the exception that the dog is now a skunk and there's only one dog. Oh, skunk.
Right.
Yeah.
One stinker of the week. I think the show is, we're doing the same thing. There are two of us, new movies open, and we review them. We have some ideas that we want to affect, and we do have more control, I think, over what's on a given show or what direction the show takes than we have before. But I don't know.
We have that control.
We have the control, yes.
That's what's interesting. Instead of, now, this may surprise you, but, and this is a very inside thing for only, I suppose, only half a dozen viewers of close watchers of the show might catch this, but I think you'll be finding us making a lot more film history references and a lot more topical references to what's going on in the world. We sort of chafed under a producer under the old regime who felt that it would be wrong to bring in too much, quote, serious film criticism and don't make references that not everybody has seen.
We called this producer Mr. Clipboard, and he had two favorite phrases. Nobody has heard about it, and the other one was, nobody wants to know that. And if you mention anything that happened before 1981, nobody had heard about it. And if you mention anything that's happening now, nobody wanted to know it.
Just stick to the movie, guys, and say whether you like it or not, and smile a lot. So we feel a little bit
levered.
This guy
is back in business. This particular person who, the last year that Sneak Previews was on the air, we got a new producer, Nancy De Los Santos, who we liked very much and who has joined us at Onto Movies. Previous producer is now back in the saddle producing the current Sneak Previews and was quoted in the Chicago Press as saying, what the public wants is clips, clips, and more clips. And he was quoted in the trade press in Chicago as saying, we'll never make the mistake again of getting two film critics to do that show.
Well, I guess...
it's nice that you asked the question. Right?
If you have any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them as well. But well, I think they do see it as a clip show. And the stars of their idea... In other words, I think they almost had to suffer our presence in a sense.
Yeah, I feel that there was some sort of... I know this sounds strange and it's old news and we can get on to the new news, but... there was obviously some ill feeling and just different attitudes towards the show. Roger and I, my full-time job is film criticism. That's what we want to do. And you can judge it for yourself whether we are doing that on our new show. I think we are. I don't find myself shading one bit. In fact, I find myself a little bit more open. There's a spirit at this new place where we're doing it that's kind of exciting. And I acknowledge to you the one difference that I will say is that as long as the ratings are good, I can be talking in this upbeat voice. It'll be interesting, and I hope we never have to cross it, where the ratings wouldn't be good. Then maybe there'll be some pressures. But right now, people, and what's encouraging is it's right out of the box. We're literally 5 weeks old, and our executive producer is saying, we got a hit here, guys. He told
Major
us,
hit.
You know.
Now, you'll know that the ratings have started to slip if you see Gene with a propeller beanie.
And Roger jumping through a hoop while giving his opinion with his thumb up in flames, you know.
Well, your names were in your names are in all the
That's an interesting image, Gene.
Yeah.
Your names are all in all the TV columns and gossip columns while the auditions were going on for the Sneak Previews, which is still on public television. Mm-hmm. Did you have your did you try to be involved in that at all and
try to be
auditions?
Involved is hardly the right question. We were not consulted. In fact, they took our picture down from the wall at the station and put up Julia Child, who hasn't made a new show in a year. We were not consulted. If we had been consulted, though, and in fact, since you ask, I'll tell you what I would have told them.
I would have told them to do exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, get those two guys. That would be great.
I would have said, that's a good idea.
Wonderful, wonderful, yes. here's what I I would have told them that, in my opinion, the three things the show had that made it interesting.
Gene, Roger, and Spot.
Right. No. First of all, that there were two of us. In other words, that you don't have one guy who's the expert. You have two people who are calling each other's bluffs, if you will, or questioning each other's opinions where that's appropriate. The second thing was we are both professional film critics. We have been working for a long time and also in other ways giving lectures. I teach a film class and so forth. So we more or less know what we're talking about. And the third thing is, we are not part of the rat race of Los Angeles and New York, the incestuous film critic circles where the critics all go to screenings with each other, and it's always kind of, how will my review position itself against what Pauline Kael says? We're from the great heartland, if you will, you know. And for the purposes of what I'm saying, the heartland is everything but New York and L.A. It's Philadelphia. It's Detroit. It's Atlanta. It's Minneapolis. I would have said, get a couple of movie critics who are out here, you know, in the nation somewhere. And they wound up with two people who have to fly in to Chicago from New York every week to do the show. This is, for a city that started out with a second city complex, this is almost, you know, a fatal blow.
And it's also great for a station that wants to save money. You know, they're paying plane fares. I mean, just it's ridiculous. But somebody told me if they were dumb enough to let you go, then they were dumb enough to do what they did after they let you go, so...
Well, I was going to ask you this, you know, very, very gently and tell you that it was perfectly okay to not answer, but I guess I don't have to do that. What do you think of their criticism on the air?
He's looking at me for all you wondering what that pause is. I'll go ahead and say. I find it very difficult to remember anything that they say shortly after they say it. And that's a pretty serious charge. In other words, I can't hear them. Now, you must realize that this is not the competitive me saying this, because obviously the competitive me wants to understand what they're saying and judge it. I find a lot of it is just air, a noise, and I don't know if they've learned how to do the job yet.
I watched the show once, so I would know what they looked like if I ever met them. And I haven't watched it since because, frankly, and I only watched the first show. So
what did you think of the first show? I don't want you to dodge the whole question.
Well, I think that they reminded me a lot of Howdy Doody and Bozo on the first show, but I think that they might get better. They seem to be so jocular that the films were totally secondary to how much they liked each other and how happy they were just to be alive and doing that show. I mean, they kept patting each other on the back and, gee, it's great, and isn't it wonderful to have a job where we get to go to these movies and talk about them on the air, and God, I'm happy.
And I don't think on the first show, I don't think I would have ever said something like, we've been doing this for 25 years now. You know, I mean, there was one remark. Plus, I don't know if you noticed, Raj, the rear shot at the end.
They shook hands.
No, there was like a thumbs up, like we made it, like two Las Vegas entertainers grasping each other and saying, hey, it's great to be in the Big Apple or whatever.
I'll tell you one thing, is I won't be watching the show again for a professional reason, and that is I've got to go into the At the Movie set and do the show every week. And I would rather do it with my own voice in my head without being, you know what I'm saying.
I know what you're saying, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, but right before you do this show, you don't come into the station listening to a screamer doing the hot hits, right? Because it doesn't put you in the right frame of mind.
No, I'll listen to that. What I won't listen to is someone doing an interview before coming here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Let me reintroduce you both. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel are my guests. They now host At the Movies, which is seen on Channel 48, 7:30 Saturday night, 7:30 Sunday night. They used to do Sneak Previews, and Sneak Previews is now seen with two different hosts on public television in the Delaware Valley on Channel 12, also Saturday night at 7:30, and Sunday night at 11 o'clock. Well, you were both from rival papers, mm-hmm. still are. But that was like your main relationship to one another.
Still is.
Before doing the show.
Still is.
What kind of tensions are there between that rival relationship that you have on print and on TV, because you're both with different TV stations.
This man is capable of hiding under tables in conference rooms to eavesdrop on my telephone calls.
That's not a real good time for me, but I will do it, just so we understand that, right?
What do you listen to?
I've only done that once. I mean, I think what you got to understand is we come from an intensely competitive newspaper town, Chicago. Regrettably, the competition has been cut in half because we used to have four newspapers when Roger and I first got started, and now it's only two. And we're the less for it, as is this town for the loss of a newspaper. And I feel bad about that. And it's a terrible thing. At the same time, we are now head-to-head in the morning and all day long now, our two newspapers, the Sun-Times that Roger writes for, the Tribune that I do. And there is the specter of, who knows, maybe someday there will only be, and it would be a tragedy, one paper in Chicago.
And then you wouldn't have a job.
only if I leave mine open for you, big fella. Okay. Now, the point is that it is a very competitive environment, and we take great delight, as a lot of journalists do, in knocking down the other guy's stories, mm-hmm. After hours, you know, telling people, you know, how great our work was in the paper that day and what a lousy thing the other guy did. And that's fairly
traditional. Chicago is still the kind of town where there are places where you can go if you want to bring along a dupe of your story and read it aloud to an admiring audience of captive victims.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful environment in that way.
You know what I mean? Sick. Gee, I wrote a good story today. You want to hear it? Yeah. You're going to.
But what that means is that Roger, during the week, 6 days a week, is the enemy in some way. And I'm trying to outdo him, and it's legitimate because he's a good critic, and he does a good job, but I want to do a better one. And in my paper, one day a week, we stop the backbiting and whatever, And we're not that vicious toward
we
each other.
We don't dislike each other personally most of the time.
But one day a week we get together and we talk together. Mm-hmm. I would recommend that, by the way, for all people in all kinds of professions. Rather than avoid your competitor,
do a show together.
Do a show together. It's worked out great for us, seriously. And we can learn from each other and do learn from each other.
I'd like to see Cooley and DeBakey or whatever his DeBakey. Name is. DeBakey looking at slides of hearts that each of the other ones had.
You know, it wouldn't be a bad show. I'm serious. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Exchange of information.
They would both know about what they were talking about. I think that's one interesting thing about the show is that people like to watch people talking about something that they're interested in talking about.
But you have got this funny relationship now because you're rivals on the one hand, but in terms of the television viewing public, you're a team, and that's even been reinforced by the fact that you left a show together. Mm-hmm. So you're a kind of
we are colleagues. We are colleagues, but we are not a team. We are colleagues who are on separate teams. Each one has one player.
When we introduce ourselves on the show, it's very purposeful. Think of how we are introduced every week. We could be introduced as anything we wanted to be.
Across the aisle from me is Gene Siskel, film critic of the Chicago Tribune. That's what he is.
And I say, and across the aisle from me is Roger Ebert, film critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. He will always be that as long as he is that. That's the main color in our life.
There's one thing that we protect very jealously, and that is if you watch the show, you can, since you're in broadcasting, you know that when we say, and now our next movie is, and we're looking straight at the camera, well, obviously we're reading a teleprompter. In other words, I've written that review, and I've had to write it because I want to get down what I'm going to say. I need time control, and also the director needs a roll cue to know what words are going to be said right before the clip starts. When I finish my review and I turn to Gene, and he tells me what he thinks about the movie, we almost have a fetish about not saying in the presence of the other person before the show is actually being taped what we're going to say. And we have to, in other words, whatever he thinks about the film, I hear it at that moment, and whatever I'm going to respond, I have to decide at that moment. It is not a case of the two of us saying, what would be a great exchange here for the benefit of the show?
We agree.
But then can you do a lot of takes afterwards if you're
working with that?
We try to do it first take.
First take, and we do it most, I would say, we're probably at 90% of the time, maybe even higher, first take on our part of that.
The only time you really break is, let's say you get a frog in your throat or something. But the fact is, there's this notion that television has to be perfect. In other words, gee, I mispronounced a word or I forgot a name or a date. That's okay. The audience understands that. We're not perfect. We're having a conversation, including all of the pauses or false starts that you might have. The point is to get down the spontaneous exchange of opinions.
I want to go back to this notion of newspaper men because I really think that is the most important part of us. If you really knew us, and you know, we're meeting here for the first time, but if you really knew us, we would be most comfortable in our newspaper offices, working on our terminals, used to be typewriters. And
kind of ominous sounding.
You know, it is, I know. And what I mean by that is, I remember when I was first hired for the local CBS station that you mentioned, and it was 8.5 years ago, and Van Gordon Sauter was the news director of the station. He's now president of CBS News. And Van called me in and said, in the past, television stations have looked around the newsroom, tried to find the person with the longest hair, and said, you go make jokes like Gene Shalit.
In other words, you're the movie critic now. You're young.
Yeah.
You look
a little weird.
Yeah.
You make jokes, okay, off the titles. Show the clip, make jokes off the titles. He said, we want to try it a little different. We got this new show we're starting. This is in 1974. He said, we wanted to find someone who knows the movie Beat and knows the movies and see if we can train them to talk in front of a camera. And that's what's happened with both Roger and myself, which is we are newspaper men talking in front of a camera.
What have you learned about the camera?
What have I learned about the camera? Not to be afraid of it and not to be... I'll tell you, now that's an interesting question. The one thing I have learned for myself, and this only applies to myself, is to put my energy into doing the show rather than to having done the show. With the exception of copies of At the Movie or editions of At the Movies that I have got to see for professional reasons, such as to review whatever we said or something, I don't watch the show. I do not watch myself on television. And I'll tell you why. Because in my early days, I did, and it made me conscious of the impression I was making, so that the center of my consciousness, instead of being on this side of the camera or this side of the microphone, was around on the other side. It was as if I wanted to be behind the camera, looking through it along with the cameraman and seeing how I looked and how I was coming across. And I realized that the important thing was to know what my opinion was and to say it. In other words, to pump it out and let it happen. And that I've got to be more concerned with my opinion than with my performance, or everything is lost. So I now just kind of ignore the camera, except for being professional enough to know where it is.
Since you are on the screen, do you find yourself watching people on the screen, movies, for instance, differently? You know, knowing like the difference between, because you're a part of it now, the difference between the image and the three-dimensional real-life thing.
Gee, that's interesting. I think that most movie critics, even before, let's say, we did television, are a little bit schizo. On the one hand, you're sitting there watching the movie as a moviegoer, and on the other hand, you're sitting there watching yourself watch it. You know, Pauline Kael says that she goes into the theater, watches the movie, and lets the movie happen to everything that she is and everything, all the experiences she's had, and then her review is a report on what happened. So that, in a way, what you're reviewing is your reaction.
Mm-hmm. I write my reviews in the newspaper more as a, I feel as a reporter. And my lead are, here's what happened inside my head today, so to speak. And that's the way I sort of organize. And I lead with the most important impression that I had, the dominant impression I had of the film. I also wanted to respond to your question about what have I learned about the camera, if I may. I thought Roger's analysis was terrific. And I just phrase it in a slightly different way. When you stare into the camera, and if people, I most guess most people know, it looks like you're looking into a black hole there, and you can barely, if you look closely, make out the actual lens. You can view that lens as benign or malevolent or neutral. Just as I might say, you can view the world that way too, the world at large. And I find in the beginning when I worked on television, I viewed it as malevolent, as accusatory, that the lens was saying there, okay, now you better do a good job. Mm-hmm. And if there's silence between us, that you better fill it, Mr. Siskel, because I'm standing here watching you. I am watching you, Mr. Lens, standing for and representing the public out there. And that's in the beginning. Now, and then frequently, that's why you'll find, I think, subconsciously, a lot of smiling done by TV performers. This is my opinion. That they want to smile into that lens.
Gene is saying this because everybody tells us we don't smile enough.
Yeah. Particularly me.
We don't want to look like we're happy.
Particularly me. I think Roger would agree you smile a little bit more, but that's...
I'm a little happier than you.
No. But I think that you see, they're smiling, these TV, there's so much congeniality, and you see it on all, it's, you know, epidemic in television. And I think it's because the television communicator wants to smile at that lens so the lens will like him or her, and that meaning that the audience will like him or her, and they will, in effect, smile back. And again, it's just another way of phrasing what Roger's saying. I try and get it out, what I think, and talk to it. We're sitting in the studio here, and I'm looking at a poster for the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and I'm looking at it now, and I'm talking to it, you know? And I'm just trying to say what
when
I think about it.
When you think that it's talking to you, Gene, let me know.
Yeah. But no, seriously, in other words, concentrate on what you're saying and leave the lens alone. It is obviously neutral.
I just like to quote Klaus Kinski, the weird German actor who was in Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and he's in... the new film, Fitzcarraldo. He made more than 147 films before Aguirre, The Wrath of God. He was in every cheap exploitation movie in six countries in Europe. And I said to him, you know, Mr. Kinski, when I interviewed him, before Aguirre, The Wrath of God, I wasn't even aware of you as an actor. I'd never seen any of your films. Can you tell me what some of the good ones were? And he said, I have never seen any of my films. Aguirre, The Wrath of God was the first one that I saw because Werner Herzog asked me to look at it. And I said, you've made 140 films and you never went to see any of them? He says, I am not paid to see my films. I am paid to act in them. You are paid to see them.
And I pay to see them.
Well.
So my guests are Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, who now host At the Movies and formerly hosted Sneak Previews. And you have a lot of power now, probably a lot more. I think that's fair to say, a lot more than you did when you were just in Chicago, though. In Chicago, I'm sure you were very influential, mm-hmm. but no one outside of that, except mm-hmm. though you both are syndicated in the papers. Anyways, with the addition of TV, you have a lot more influence mm-hmm. than you did before. How are you trying to use that so that the influence you have can do what you think would benefit consumers in the film industry?
Well, in a curious way, I think my first response is to say that I'm going to treat that power that we have, and I agree that we have it, certainly in potential form, as the camera lens, which is I'll just say what I think and then let the magnification of that through the distribution channels of the television mm-hmm. system take care of itself. Again, I think if you start to get into active use of that, I think you can become dangerously boring and pedantic mm-hmm. and pompous. What's nice, of course, is that we got another guy sitting over there that if one guy starts to freak out,
the other guy says,
hey,
you're
cool
full
it.
Of it. Yeah.
You cool it. Because, again, we are individuals. And I don't want to see Roger start screwing.
But I remember, like with Barbara.
Screwing up, you were about to
say. Yeah, I did.
Thank you very much.
With Barbarossa, though, for instance, uh-huh. I remember you sitting
let me tell you the story.
A few weeks in a row saying to the studios, release this film.
Can I tell you the story of Barbarossa? Because it'll be instructive. And I think it's not, I must tell you, though, it is not, well, I'll tell the story, you see if it's a use of power, what it is. Barbarossa is a film, a Western, and we don't have many these days, directed by Fred Shepsie, a very talented Australian filmmaker. The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith is a terrific film that he did. Barbarossa is with two wonderful actors, Gary Busey and Willie Nelson. And it came to Chicago, and I got a tip that it was going to be played off at the bottom half of some double bills in drive-ins with Conan the Barbarian without any advertising whatsoever. And so I was looking for it, and it popped. Well, I looked around and found that it was playing only in one enclosed theater, and that was the Dunes Plaza Theater in Michigan City, Indiana, which is about 55 miles south of Chicago, southeast. And I drove out there, and I saw it there, and came back and wrote my review and liked the film very, very much. I gave it 3.5 stars out of 4 and thought it was a terrific motion picture, and like other Fred Skepsis films, the landscape became as rich a character as the mm-hmm. characters themselves. Roger was out of town for some reason.
I was at the film festival.
And so, which one?
Cannes Film Festival. Okay. It was in May.
And so he came back, and frequently on sneak previews, I mean, people always ask us, you know, how do you decide which pictures to play? We got a problem just getting enough to review. And so we were hunting around when Roger came back for films, and I said, well, God, I saw this film Barbarossa, and I thought it was terrific. I reviewed it. Let's do that. And so that's nice. We then called
Universal Pictures.
And they wouldn't screen it for Roger. So
this is despite the fact that they already knew if they were thinking in this way, that Gene liked it.
So they had one yes vote, if you want to go back to the old format, for sure. And then we were sitting around, and I remember how this happened, Rog. Roger had to come up with a dog of the week. Frequently, it gets that we tape on Thursdays. It has to come down.
I said, the one thing that offends me more this week than any bad movie playing in town is the fact that a potentially good movie is not playing here or anywhere else. Because what happens, you see, that picture was a pickup deal. That was made not by Universal, but by a group of people who then sold the rights to distribute it to Universal, so that there was nobody at Universal who had a stake in it. In other words, nobody's career was on the line. It had been opened, and it had been determined that it was a flop. Therefore, a decision had been made to withdraw it from release. So at this point, it becomes that the guy who's the only person who has whose career is at stake in connection with this film is the person who took it out of release, so that his career is affected, oddly enough, if it goes back into release and is successful.
Because then he's proven wrong.
You see, so that instead of everybody at the studio working to make the picture successful so they'll look good, you had somebody at the studio working to make the picture look unsuccessful so he'd look good. And this was, and so at this case, the movie didn't have a chance. So then we did, as you saw, we mentioned it one week, we mentioned it another week. Mm-hmm. Finally, we saw the film. I admired it as well as Gene did. And other people have too.
But all that is, I mean, you could think that's a power play, but really what it came down to is just give wanted it, to see the picture.
Give it a chance.
He wasn't going to perforce love the film because it was an endangered creature now. He's an honest critic. He wouldn't have done that. We still would have had a standard review. Basically, it was done, again, first and foremost, we needed a picture to review. And second, he was offended by the fact that they wouldn't show him a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel are my guests. Do you try to keep up with schlock films? Like
yeah.
With the latest, even kung fu films? And
Here's a funny thing. The edition of, on sneak previews, we called it the Dog of the Week. On At the Movies, it's called the Stinker of the Week, and we have Aroma the Educated Skunk. You know, it's interesting. Film critics these days all have to be familiar with animals. I think our new
Have you had your shots?
Yes,
yeah,
my
okay.
new co-host next week, Gene, is going to be Marlon Perkins.
All right.
When we were only reviewing for the newspapers, I think we gave a pass to some movies that would appear to be unreviewable. Now, because we are...
Now we review them.
Now we review them. And so once a week or so, you have to venture out into some sleaze pit, you know, with your steel-toed shoes on for mice bites. And because we see these kung fu movies, triple features for $1.25, you know that that's not a real high-class theater. And see a movie like this. Now, here's what happens. Occasionally, just often enough to keep it interesting, it's just like looking for the pearl in the oyster. You find a pearl. Most of the time, you only find oysters.
Rotten oysters.
Yes.
Swamp Thing was one of those.
You go to see Swamp. I went to see. I have to admit to you, it sounded to me like it wasn't going to be any good. And I went to see it, and it was good. And I called up Gene, and I said, I got a movie that you have to see. It's not a dog.
Mm-hmm. I had a similar example with a film called High Risk that I went on a Wednesday night, because we tape on Thursdays, and we were hunting for dogs. And can you imagine someone just listening in on the show? They think it's an animal
hour. Who
else
do you know who says, here it is Wednesday night, and I've got to find a bad movie?
Right. So, yeah, that's how we've changed. And so... I went to see High Risk, and I liked it. What can I do about it? I liked it. I'm not going to lie in the air. So we put it in, and I think I told the story of I went looking for a bad film and found a good one, and here's what it is.
You know, he's got to tell the truth. He's right. The idiotic thing, Variety had a review of Sneak Previews. Now, this is not an attack on Sneak Previews. It's an attack on Variety. The critic for Variety said they seem to be disagreeing a lot. This should be encouraged. He obviously didn't think about what he was saying. In other words, don't give your honest opinions. If you agree, one of you should pretend to disagree because that will make it a better show.
It's instructive, though, going to see schlock.
Movies are kind of a pipeline to the collective dreams of the country. And Gene, in fact, has a wonderful line. He says the movie critic is covering the national dream beat because what people, the reveries that people choose to share in the dark tell you a lot about where they're at. And a lot of people go to see schlock. There is a reason, I guess, why people go to see the dead teenager movies and the mad slasher movies and why they go to see, and here's what I can't understand, though. Maybe you can explain. Why they go to see kung fu movies over and over and over again. In the course of my job in the last 5 years, I've probably seen 50 or 60 kung fu movies. I've seen a couple of good ones, including the Chuck Norris picture Force 5, which we...
Force Vengeance?
Force Vengeance might have been the one.
Mm-hmm.
Couple good ones, and the rest, they're not particularly violent.
I saw
they don't
one.
Make any sense at all. They're incoherent. There's still a market for them, and I just, it's a mystery
fodder.
To me.
It's like it's fodder. It's like turning on television or turning on most radio stations, and it's noise that'll keep you company. And we have theaters that open up at 9 in the morning. And in Chicago downtown, and a lot of these films play there, and it's like noise. 9 o'clock, I can get in there and be distracted and lose myself with this noise on the screen and laugh at a few jokey people. I think in a curious way that a lot of people go and laugh at the characters on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and typically the people that are going are the lower socioeconomic ladder to be going at 9 in the morning.
And when you look at somebody... in Fists of Vengeance and Elbows of Defeat, flipping around and getting a karate blade.
With the words missing their lips because of the poor soundtrack, you can feel superior.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to tell you is that a curious thing that has happened out of... I agree with you that you can find a lot in schlock, and probably the most popular show we ever did under the old format was a film called Women in Danger Films, Violence Directed at Women. And the film that triggered... that was a schlock film and, indeed, a dog of the week. It was called I Spit on Your Grave. And what Roger and I realized is suddenly, independently, we came to the realization, having seen a lot of this mad slasher junk, that we, if we didn't have our jobs, or even if we had our jobs and were supposed to be a little bit more esoteric critics, might have skipped entirely, there was this whole subgenre. And now I identified it in my article about it in the newspaper as not a subgenre or minor genre, but a major genre in American movies. Bigger than the Western, bigger than the musical, bigger almost, in fact, than the love story, was the hate story, and the hate story of men against women, cutting them up. You act independent as a woman, you get knifed for it. Love me or I'll slash you. And that came out of us going to see these supposedly awful movies that a lot of people were seeing and continue to see.
A question that I think everybody's trying to answer is there any relationship between what happens on screen and what people do when they leave the theater afterwards, and do films where women get slashed up inspire or incite men to go and commit similar crimes? What kind of connection do you think there is? I mean, I know you're looking at it as a film critic and not as a sociologist or
behavior scientist
or anything, but I'm sure you have opinions on it. And I'd also love to hear if you feel like you've seen any movies in your life that have made you think things or imagine things that you wish you had never been exposed to.
I want to ask you a question in connection with that question. When people... Isn't it possible that, apart from the fact that people might go to see a movie that would make them want to do something or be something, isn't it possible that people who wanted to do or be something might go to the movies so that in their minds they could do or be it? Isn't it possible that violent movies, and I'm not defending or attacking violent movies, because as a critic I would judge each one on its own merits, but isn't it possible that since the movie provides you with a substitute experience, a voyeuristic escapist experience, it would be more accurate to say that movies attract the kind of people who watch them than to say that certain kinds of movies create the kinds of people who would imitate them?
And then the next question is, do they exaggerate that quality? So if someone is you know, kind of into murder, if they go to a lot of horror films, will they become more so? I don't know if you'd
even
want
to
mention that.
Well, let me tell you, I have done, I'll try to do a lot of thinking and reporting on this subject. And here's sort of the bottom line for me, and I'll use the example of the mad slasher Women in Danger films, where in their cinematic style, you stalk the woman right with the camera, so that it's basically, it's you pay $4 and you can participate in a rape, visual rape. Here's what I think, and I'm talking about some of the worst films I've seen, the cruelest, meanest. I'm not sure that it causes people to go out and start attacking, but this, I believe, is undeniable and bad about it. What is undeniable is that this creates a climate where watching women get attacked is presented under the guise of the label of entertainment. You pay $4 and you're going in and let's see somebody get terrorized. And that, I think a lot of people would say, that's not entertainment. That's what the whole campaign against rape jokes was all about. That, don't you understand what you're talking about when you say a rape joke? Don't you understand you're talking about somebody being forced to do something against their will, being abused? That's not funny. That's not a fit subject for joke. Well, I wonder if some of these films are fit subjects for entertainment. It's presented in the form of entertainment. Ha, 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 look at her get terrorized. And I am quite clear on all the First Amendment freedoms, and you notice I didn't say that they shouldn't be made, but when I talk about fit, I'm really talking about taste.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these films are
tasteless. You see, because I believe the films have a right to be made and a right to be shown. And I also believe that an exhibitor has a right not to show them. Now, in the case of I Spit on Your Grave, which is one of the most offensive films ever made, it was playing at the United Artists Theater in Chicago, owned by the Plitt Chain. It turned out that it had been booked without any high official at the Plitt Chain having seen it.
Which is typical.
Typical. They don't even know what they're showing. And the question then becomes, okay, sir, this is your theater, you own it, and this is the movie you're playing. Do you like it? Well, I haven't seen it. Do you know what's in it? No, I don't. It's another one of those exploitation films, isn't it? That's that's irresponsible. I think that if a person is going, I think a person has a right to show a film, but I think he has a responsibility to see it first and then decide in his own mind, is this the kind of film I want to show in my theater? Am I the kind of person who wants to show this film? Am I the kind of person who wants to live off the earnings of images that degrade women? And if his answer is yes, then I say he has a right to do it. And also, of course, I have a right to attack him for it.
Do you think that that trend has diminished at all, that there's less of those films?
Maybe a little. Maybe a little. People just get tired of it, you know.
Maybe just a little. But it's still the single, I think the horror film is the single most profitable category of film, reliably profitable. They don't have to be made for very much money. You don't need stars. The pattern of filmmaking is well known. And the method of selling, that's the other part. The TV ad is a breeze to create that. And mm-hmm. so the sale to the production head is easy. I'm going to make the scariest film ever made. You thought Friday the 13th was scary? I'm going to mm-hmm. really make them jump out of their seats. But you try and sell to a production head, just to pick a picture. I'm going to do this story about these teenagers in a wealthy suburb north of Chicago, and they've got emotional problems. The whole family's sort of cold, and the guy said, wait a minute.
I'm going to make a movie about four kids in southern Indiana who get up a team to win a bicycle race.
Yeah, that sounds weird.
Can't make those movies very easily.
Have you ever seen a film that you wish you hadn't because there was an image that was so kind of frightening to you? And
there was an image in I Spit
Recall.
On Your Grave.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There was an image in I Spit on Your Grave in which the woman is pleading. I'm not even going to describe the image because it doesn't serve any purpose to describe it, but there was an image I wish I hadn't seen, that's for sure. Yet, this is the dilemma I'm in. I've seen horrible images in other films that I thought were great films. It's hard to imagine anything more violent than the shootout at the conclusion of Taxi Driver, which I think is one of the greatest films ever made. So that I believe, this is not a very original opinion, but I think that we have to keep saying it. Subject matter is not the criteria for the quality, the criteria is the artistry. Mm-hmm. Any subject matter whatsoever is valid as a subject for art. The question that the critic and the consumer of art, the audience, has got to ask is this a valid use of the subject matter, and is this a good film?
It leads me to another question. What's the difference between a good film and a film that you put in the category of guilty pleasure? What's the difference besides the guilt?
Well, that's the major thing. Guilt. Things I'm sort of embarrassed to admit I like. In other words, it's not very conventional to say, I liked Emmanuel, which was one of my guilty pleasures. I mean, you're not supposed... one of the categories that is frequently missing from film criticism...
is honesty about one's own reaction.
About erotic images. America is guilty about sex.
Let me see.
And it's much more, I love that shootout. I love that car crash. Burt Reynolds just ripped me up when he went through that billboard.
Let me tell you where Gene's leading, because he may be too modest to... I doubt if he's too modest, but anyway, I can't wait to talk.
Okay.
Gene, we did a show called Guilty Pleasures, and one of his choices was Emmanuel. And he said that he liked it because it turned him on. Okay, now that's pretty simple. I mean, college kids stand around and, there are women who like Richard Gere. There are men who like Claudia Cardinale and so forth. And there are men who like Richard Gere too, right. I ask you, how long has it been since you have heard a film critic or seen a film critic or read a film critic in any medium admit to being erotically aroused by anything? I laughed till I thought my sides would split, Tears ran down my cheeks.
The most profoundly moving film in my experience.
Yes, but Al Goldstein is the only previous film critic who said, 98%.
Right, on his famous meter, yeah.
So that's one of the differences between a guilty pleasure and...
Well, let me ask you this. Don't you have two foods that you secretly mix together and eat that everybody would be shocked if they found out you ate them at the same time?
Most likely.
Don't you, for example, sometimes when you're alone, put ketchup on cottage cheese?
Oh, God, no.
No?
Hope I haven't given you that impression.
No, well, you seem like a cottage cheese and ketchup person, but I haven't known you very long.
No.
Well, aren't there things that
you... Why don't you say what... You might as well confess it. What do you do, Raj?
I don't... I like to put vanilla, the powdered vanilla breakfast substitute into my coffee maker and then make coffee on top of it and stir it up and drink it.
Welcome to Julia Child.
No, I'm not. You know, I'm talking about Carnation Instant Breakfast, vanilla flavor. I like to pour it into coffee.
Oh, well, that's not so
bad. Well,
you're ashamed?
Well, I don't think that the cottage cheese and ketchup is so bad either, but you thought it was appalling. What I'm saying is that's a guilty pleasure. It tastes just as good as something respectable. You
but
know
if
what
people
I mean?
Were around, you wouldn't own up to it, and you wouldn't do it in front of guests.
You don't. Yeah, you don't put ketchup on the cottage cheese in a restaurant, but you do it at home. And by the same token, you go to see Swamp Thing, but you don't ordinarily tell everybody that you do.
Right.
Yeah. Swamp Thing is... Yeah.
Or Inframan. Inframan is another great one.
Yeah. Is there a movie that you feel has like really been very important in developing your film sensibility?
One recently, and it made me recognize what I value in film. And that would be My Dinner with Andre. And what I mean by that is it made me realize how much I love films that dare to be different. That's the general statement. Specifically, it made me realize how I often have used, before I saw this movie, the phrase, and some people said I use it too often, these people don't seem real to me. What they're talking, it was about other movies. These characters don't seem as interesting as anybody I've ever met in my life. And you call this a movie? It's garbage. It doesn't seem to be real. Lively is another word. Well, now I see this film called My Dinner with Andre, which is a conversation between two men over dinner and about life's most important issues, how to be more honest, how to be more alive. And it's just conversation. And I realized immediately, don't back off a bit, because here are two guys that are alive. And I tell you, these characters are as rich characters as any I've ever seen in the movies. Mm-hmm. In fact, and this is so curious, whenever I see these actors, Andre Gregory or Wallace Shawn, in bit parts since that film, and they have been only getting bit parts, whenever I see, for example, Atlantic City, and Wally Shawn is the waiter in there in a tiny little scene.
You know, Andre Gregory is the director and author.
Right. At the beginning of the film. Mm-hmm. My eyes light up. Hey, there's Wally. There's Andre. And I'm knowing them from the movie.
I'll tell you the two films that kind of influenced me in that way, one in terms of my heart and the other in terms of my mind. The first would be The Third Man, the great film set in Vienna with Orson Welles and Joseph Cotten and so forth, which gave me such a sense of sheer pleasure in watching a film when I saw it. And at the time I saw it, I believe I was 18 years old, and I was in Europe for the first time, and I saw it in a theater in Paris, that it forever set my course in the direction of a movie theater. I mean, I'll be going to the movies whether or not I'm a movie critic. The second one affected my mind in the way that The Third Man affected my heart, and it was Bonnie and Clyde, which I saw shortly after I became a movie critic. And it's a film that I feel is one of the great American films, but more importantly than that for me, I was aware of it as filmmaking. That it was not a gangster story, it wasn't a love story, it was a succession of images, and the images were what were affecting me. So those would be two good ones.
Does seeing movies all the time and then having to immediately have opinions of them that you're willing to go public with ever get to be either difficult or absurd? Absurd in the sense that when you repeat an action over and over again, sometimes it kind of momentarily loses its meaning and you have to stop yourself a minute.
The action doesn't... That's a more interesting
question. I would agree with
you. Sometimes you go to see movies that you feel are just absolutely so lacking in any interest that it's no job for a normal adult to be in the theater looking at them. You're just appalled by the fact that you've been insulted by the fact that somebody felt that it was worth 2 hours of your time to see this junk. But on the other hand, if the movie is at all worthy of attention for good or bad reasons, for example, Monsignor, which is opening in Philadelphia, is an appalling movie, which is fascinating in that you cannot believe from moment to moment the things that you're seeing on the screen, then that can be interesting. What does bother me a little bit, when the film critic of the Sun-Times, who had the job before I did, when she retired, she was asked what she wouldn't miss about the job, and she said, "I won't miss being asked if I've seen any good movies lately." One of the problems you have is that everybody in the world had just seen a movie and they all want to talk about it right now. There comes a point when even a movie critic would just as soon talk about things in general.
Well, I think, you know, what you're asking is, does the job become routine or do you get dulled by it in some way? And the thing that bothers me, I can respond with energy to a film that is extremely good or a film that is extremely bad. It's very easy, and I love doing that. There is this gray middle mush pile of films in the middle that don't seem to... The creativity stopped with The Deal, with the assemblage...
Author is an example.
With the assemblage of the actors and the director and all that package, frequently done by the same agent putting his clients in different roles, that is lifeless. It's phony. It's like TV sitcom material that is just some weird, weird thing going on there. And then I'm really faced with a real writing challenge at the paper, which is how do I develop the energy, the creative energy, to respond to this when it is absolutely lifeless, when the thing I would like most is to just walk away from it and not regard it or not spend any time on it. That's when the film is dull. You also raise another interesting aspect in your question, which is, but this is true of every task that is done, as you quite well say, with repetition, which is you better keep fresh. You better build in some way of keeping fresh. And oddly enough, one of the ways that I build in keeping fresh is that I have this other guy once a week sitting across from me who may not be on the same cycle as I am, and he can keep me fresh. He keeps me accountable.
There's another thing I do to keep – I agree with that, and I have another thing. For 12 years, I've taught a film class in the Extension Division of the University of Chicago, and we spend 3.5 hours once a week on films, and occasionally we use a stop-action film analyzer, and we'll spend 10 hours going through a two-hour film a shot at a time. So that's kind of like a, you know, once you, you know, you've gotten accustomed to seeing the movie and reviewing it instantly, so to speak, as you said, it's interesting as a discipline to also go back and spend a very long time looking at a particular film to see what made it work.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel are my guests. You're both quoted a lot in the film ads now when a movie opens. Are you frequently quoted out of context? Has that ever happened?
Let me tell you something. Well, usually it doesn't happen, but sometimes it does. There are kinds of things that I will not say.
Dazzling.
And no, we're reading some quotes in the New York Times this morning, and without naming any critic, we thought there were quotes and there were critics. These are things that people don't say, believe, or... And something happened to me recently that really kind of made me mad. A movie called Sheikah, spelled with an X, opened in Chicago, and I reviewed it. It had its American premiere in Chicago. When it opened in New York, the ads came out and it said, "Move over, Evita. It's Sheikah's turn now." Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times.
I wanted to vomit when I read that.
I picked up the phone and I called the publicist in New York and I said, "I didn't say that." And she said, "Yes, you did." And I said, "I am incapable of saying that. Never in my life have I ever written a review saying, 'Move over, Evita, it's Sheikah's time now.' That's the sort of thing that blank, blank, blank would say, but I would never say it. She says, I have the clipping in front of me." I looked up my review in the paper, and I was horrified to see that she had quoted the headline. I don't write the headlines. Some headline writer wrote it. It's a bad headline. It's terrible. It's film criticism.
Mm-hmm.
What was the ad that we saw as we were walking into Penn Station this morning?
I can't remember, Roger. I don't remember which film it was either. I just had drawn a blank.
Yeah, it was that sort of, you know.
Let me just tell you.
It's blank's time now is the sort of thing that passes for film criticism and movie ads, but I'll never write anything like that.
You know, in linguistics, there's the concept of, you know whether something has a referent or not, and whether it refers to anything. And some of the blurbs, you can study them. Some of them have no referent whatsoever, other than the writer's inability to express what's in his system. Dazzling. It wasn't dazzling. I mean, they weren't dazzled there. It's.
I don't think I've ever used the word dazzling in a movie review. I don't think I've ever used it even once.
It's fakey. See, the challenge is to have words that describe something that's really there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're dazzled, then you have to be truly dazzled. And that word pops up so often that I will use compelling a lot because I feel that's what's happened. I am compelled to look. Mm-hmm. I saw it in the performance of this Klaus Maria Brandauer in the movie Mephisto, which just opened in Chicago and we're reviewing on At the Movies in about a week, I think. And that's compelling to me. Mm-hmm. But it's referring to what happened to me when I was in the theater. I was drawn to the screen.
We're about out of time, but there's one very practical question I'd like to ask you about the show that you do. How do you get the clips? Can you choose any part of the movie you want to?
Frequently we're allowed to get a print of the film and make our own clips of the scenes we want to quote. On other occasions, we are limited to the clips made available by the studio.
We always try to get fresh ones.
When we can.
Well, I enjoy your show very much, and I want to thank
we
you.
Enjoy
so
this
much
was a
for
wonderful
here.
Conversation. I really enjoyed being here today.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I
we
really
have, we
it
don't
too.
Get normally this long of an uninterrupted conversation.
With such a great person to talk to.
Oh, thank you. I do wish we had more time, actually, but thanks so much for coming. I really do appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel have been my guests, two Chicago-based film critics. They used to be the hosts of Sneak Previews on public television. They recently started another show commercially syndicated called At the Movies. In Philadelphia, you can see it on Channel 48. It's on Saturday nights at 7:30 with a repeat Sunday night at 7:30. Sneak Previews is still on the air on public television with two different hosts on it, and that's still on Saturday at 7:30 with a repeat Sunday at 11. So the Roger Ebert Gene Siskel show is on Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 11.
We do have longer time.
No, Sunday at 7:30. Well,
7:30 both days.
Right.
Saturday and Sunday, Channel 48.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Nice.
And it's 4:45. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to 91 FM.
Science now has really revolutionized the screen. Things out there in Hollywood are not so darn serene. All the stars are in a panic. Here's the reason why. Everyone must talk out loud or kiss the town goodbye. Lots of old-time stars are out of a job. All they do is blubber and sob ever since the movies learned to talk. And a red-hot vamp who registers cash sounds as if she's ordering hash ever since the movies learned to talk. Oh, they can't fool you and they can't fool me. When they open up, it's a squeak. It's a sin even Rin-Tin-Tin has a bark that sounds like a peak. When the hero sings Sleep in the Deep, he sounds just like Little Bo Peep ever since the movies learned to talk. Every bathroom singer has a chance to make a name. Any guy with leather lungs can crash the Hall of Fame. If you know your vo-de-do and do-re-mi-fa-so, you can go to Hollywood and make a lot of dough. And when the villain starts the gal in his toils, she says, take your dirty old coils. Ever since the movies learn to talk. And when Emil Jannings opens his mouth, you'd swear he was raised in the South. Ever since the movies learn to talk. When a dark-eyed dame with a foreign name starts a-talking, doing a scene, we all know she's from Buffalo and her Christian name is Epstein. Though the hero's big, still everyone knows he makes every stitch of his clothes ever since the movies learned to talk. And when a baritone who used to sell fish now sings bass to Lillian Gish ever since the movies learned to talk. And when you hear the breezes blow through the trees, it's a stagehand trying to sneeze ever since the movies learned to talk. Though you're just a clerk, if your tonsils work, it's a cinch for you to make good. Spray your throat, hit a high C note, pop off a Dear Hollywood. You can be a star, all you gotta know is your old vo-do-de-o-do ever since the movies learned to talk.
Irving Kaufman singing Ever Since the Movies Learned to Talk, and it's 12 minutes to 5. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Often at the end of Fresh Air, you've heard me, when giving the names of technical directors, mention the name of Joyce Lieberman. And tonight, when the show is closed, it will be the last time that I mention her name on the program as the technical director for the next few months. It'll be the last time because, well, she's due in 2 weeks to have her first baby. And although we're all going to miss her for the next few months while she's out on maternity leave, we're all very excited about this event. So I want to play a couple of baby-type songs for you. And here's Irving Kaufman once again.
Rosie
cheeks and turned up nose and curly hair. I'm raving about my baby now, a pretty little dimple here and dimple there. Don't want to live without her, I love her, goodness knows. I wrote a song about her, and here's the way it goes. Baby face, you've got the cutest little baby face. There's not another one could take your place. Baby face, my poor heart is jumping, you sure did start in something. Baby face, I'm up in heaven when I'm in your fond embrace. I didn't need a shove, 'cause I just fell in love with your pretty baby face. Now when you were a baby not so long ago, you must have been the cutest thing. Why, I can picture you at every baby show, just winning every ribbon with your sweet baby way. Say honest, I ain't fibbin', you'd win them all today with your baby face. You've got the cutest little baby face, say. There's not another one could take your place. Baby face, my poor heart is jumping, you sure have started something. Baby face, I'm up in heaven when I'm in your fond embrace. I didn't need a shout, 'cause I just fell in love with your pretty baby face. Yo-di-do-di-do, yo-di-wo-do-do. With your sweet baby face, I'm up in heaven when I'm in your fond embrace. I didn't need a shove, 'cause I just fell in love with your pretty baby face.
Simon at the fair, met a pieman who was there. About those two guys, I don't care. I need rhythm in my nursery rhyme.
Thank you.
Tommy Dorsey and the band and Rhythm in My Nursery Rhymes, and we opened that set with Irving Kaufman singing Babyface, and Joyce Lieberman, our technical director for this afternoon, is about to leave us for a few months on maternity leave. And Joyce and Sherman, we wish you the best. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Larry King, who is America's number one coast-to-coast two-way talk radio star, and his show's on in the middle of the night, carried here on CAU. And he's written an autobiography called Larry King on Larry King. So we'll be talking about his approach to interviewing and two-way talk radio Monday at 2 o'clock. Following that interview at about 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by John Zacherle, who's known to Philadelphians as Roland. And in New York, where I grew up, he was known as Zacherle. And he used to be this crazy ghoul on the Saturday morning horror movies, and he'd during the cutaways of the movies, before he'd go to commercial, you'd see Zacherle, and he'd be there in his kind of ghoulish workshop, throwing skulls and bones around and doing all kinds of crazy things. I'm sure the Count Floyd character is in some ways a tribute to him. Then he was also an FM rock disc jockey for a while on WNEW-FM. So he'll be with us at about 3 o'clock Monday afternoon. At 3:40, Judy Stein will review museum and gallery shows. And at 4 o'clock, we continue the Billy Taylor series, Taylor Made Piano. And he'll be featuring Blues and Boogie, featuring Mary Lou Williams, Earl Hines, Count Basie, and others.